Hello, time travelers, and welcome back to Biblical Time Machine. This is our medical and healthcare edition. So if you've been waiting to hear what kinds of terrible things ancient doctors did to people and what kind of lengths people would go through just to feel better, this is the episode for you. Helen, we were just laughing because the way that they were describing sort of all the ancient healers and healthcare experts, like, it was very Monty Python, wasn't it? You could picture them all lined up in a market, you know, selling their wares.
I know. One techniques. Saying, I'll tell you to go on a walk, and the other saying, I'll drill a hole in your head, and somebody else saying, I'll spit on you. I mean, it's all kind of crazy. Which is the best option? Maybe you just go for a walk and hope for the best.
I don't know. I think if you're feeling bad enough, you just get everything and be like, I'll take an ounce of spit, just a small hole in the head, please, and I'll take a nice walk. Hopefully feel better tomorrow. Well, we have an excellent guest to talk about it. We have Jared Secord. He's a historian of kind of ancient Greek and Roman history, and he co-authored a book with two other scholars, Christy Upson-Saya and Heidi Marks. This book, and we will have a link in the show description, is called Medicine, Health, and Healing in the Ancient Mediterranean, 500 BCE to 600 CE, a source book. So that's a nice chunk of time, and that includes some, you know, kind of Hebrew Bible and New Testament times. And, you know, we assume that healthcare and health issues were probably roughly the same in, you know, Rome as they were in ancient Israel. So I think a lot of these things crossover. And Helen, I think some of the most interesting stuff he talks about is, like, some of the things that Jesus was doing as a healer, those were kind of other things that people were doing as physicians, right?
Yeah.
That kind of struck me as fascinating.
Exactly. It's a healer of his time. So he might have been more successful than others.
Including really spit, including the power spit.
Yeah, and even sort of the idea that demon possession is, you know, going to lead to some kind of mental health issues. And sure, yeah.
If you want to learn more about healthcare and medicine in the ancient world, go over to Bible Odyssey, our content partner. I'm seeing articles about medicine in the Hebrew Bible, magic in the first century world. Here's one about disability in the New Testament and barrenness. Anyway, lots of cool resources over at Bible Odyssey, as always. But for now, let's get to our fascinating and slightly disgusting conversation with Jared Secord about health and healthcare in the ancient world. Well, Jared Secord, welcome to Biblical Time Machine.
Thank you for having me today. I'm happy to talk about everything relating to ancient medicine.
All right, perfect. Well, I want to set the stage. We've talked to other guests and experts about life in the ancient world. It's hard. It's tough. It's disgusting. People die left and right. So if we could try to put a number on life expectancy, like how long could you hope to make it in the ancient Mediterranean?
So that is the good question here in terms of just thinking about that. The number that you'll typically see in books that talk about demography and things like this, they'll normally say 25 to 30 years. That's how long someone could expect to live. But I think the detail that's always important here is so many children died at such a young age that they bring that age down quite a bit. So if you make it to at least age 5, your chances of living to maybe not the life that we might expect in a modern, wealthy, industrialized country today, but we could expect people to live a fair bit longer than just that kind of disturbing 25 to 30 year figure.
So if you make it to 5, because like you said, sadly, you're looking at that chart. So many of the deaths are in infancy and before 5. So you make it to 5, maybe you got a good chance of getting to 40 or 50.
I'd say even more than that. There's this there's this strange work that I enjoy. It's a pretty short little essay, and it's just a list of people who live to be really old. It was written in the 2nd century CE, and the threshold it has for people who ended up being really old is about 80 years.
Oh, wow.
So when you think in those terms, right, like, I don't want to say that 80 years is really, like, a long life these days, but, yeah, their magic number still seem to be maybe around the same sort of territory as what we might think today. So,
yeah, because the biblical authors talk about 80 years and 10, so there must have been some concept that there were people, you know, some people. Well,
biblical authors are talking about 300 and 500 years. Yeah, so I don't know if we can go by that.
So you made a really good point in the book that during their short lives, most people expected to be sick or infirmed in some way, pretty much all the time, and that good health was just sort of an occasional episode. So, I mean, that's quite hard for people to get their heads around. I mean, so what do you think this life was like?
Yeah, I mean, I don't fully know what to say about that, in the sense that it's, you know, that there's a passage that we cite in the book that is this Roman author who's always complaining about being sick. And he talks about how he enjoyed a lengthier period of health than usual, which I think is a nice way of putting it, right? It's like, it wasn't, you know, I was sick for a little while. No, I was healthy for a longer time than I'd expect, which I like that perspective.
I know people like that.
That's true.
I was thinking that is true.
But I think that the point that I like keeping in mind is that, you know, it's maybe sometimes too easy for people who have the privileges and have everything that goes into potentially being healthy, right, and having that longer period of time. And I do always want to think about the perspective of people who might experience chronic pain or have chronic illnesses, have an undiagnosed condition, people who live in places where healthcare isn't really accessible. So I think that the perspective of ancient people who were, you know, talking about, I was healthier for longer than usual, you know, recently, I think that we should be thinking about the perspective of people in all sorts of different conditions all over the world with all sorts of different life circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's the perspective that I want to try to keep in mind when I read the ancient authors, you know, talking about this.
He does remind me of me. I think I see life in the same way. He's like, well, last night I slept well. And that's like the one, you know, the one night out of the last month. Anyway, I want to talk about, you said something really interesting in the book, something about how, you know, people in some public documents were identified by their scars. I mean, it kind of struck me, this idea that, like, clearly, you know, if you got cut by something or you had some kind of accident, they didn't have great health care, so you're going to have this probably pretty visible disfiguring scar for the rest of your life. Does that sound like it was kind of rampant in the ancient world, this idea of people just having very visible scars and disfiguring accidents?
I mean, from some documents, yes, absolutely. You know, the detail that I liked, we have this set of contracts that survive from Roman Egypt, basically, that you know, we'll talk about, you know, this is between so-and-so who had a scar on the elbow. And then the detail that jumps out is, sometimes a person might be identified as they don't have any scars, as if that's sort of a notable sort of feature, right? that sort of style of thing. I mean, I think that part of this gets us back to things about ancient sort of ways of identifying people and ancient ways of even sort of naming people. This is a digression, but not a long one, I promise, that there's a story about the Roman orator Cicero, right? So Cicero's name is derived from the Latin name for chickpea. And the suggestion in antiquity about this, and this might not be true, but the suggestion in antiquity was that name came from one of his ancestors who had a wart in the shape of a chickpea on his nose. So the name kind of stuck and became a family name at that point. So when you think about, like, people having these sort of visible markers on them, and then it even actually becoming part of someone's name, which is a really interesting example with Cicero.
Old chickpea nose,
classic.
Can you describe living conditions then in the ancient Mediterranean? What are the factors then in terms of people's lives and the way they're going about their lives that contributes to the rapid spread of these diseases and illnesses and all the rest?
Yeah, so lots of different factors here. The housing that people had, especially poorer people, would be unsafe, overcrowded. People would be living in a city like Rome. People would be living with an extremely high population density, more than you would expect in, you know, even the biggest and sort of densest modern cities. You did poor ventilation when it was cold. People would have, you know, fires burning inside. You'd have people who'd be getting all sorts of breathing issues as a result. Not really any good building codes. So, you know, you'd have a 10-story apartment building in Rome that might just come down at any time, right?
Wow. And
the cheapest apartments were the ones on the top floors too, because those were the most dangerous ones. There's lots of other stuff too, right? If you're thinking about sewage draining directly into water, and people did have an awareness, you know, where the sewer drains into the river, you probably don't want to eat the fish that come from that part of the river, that sort of thing. You've got lead pipes for water. You've got all types of different things. Never mind any sort of workplace safety concerns. So there's a huge host of considerations that are just going to make it hard to escape injury and maybe escape death even under some circumstances too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, when we talk about traveling back to these times, it always comes back to, you know, food and water and like the pathogens, the microbes, the stuff that must be swarming in these things. So, I mean, this is kind of a crass way of saying it, but do we see evidence in the documents? Like, do people kind of always complain about, like, quote-unquote stomach issues? Like, did they have kind of diarrhea all the time? Like, that's just my assumption. I don't know.
This is the most important question to ask.
Yes.
Really, about this.
That's what I thought.
I mean, the ancient medical sources do indicate that the diarrhea and stomach issues were going to be fairly common sorts of things, especially in some climates and some times of the year. So, you know, summer was going to be a bad time for that, basically, is the sense we get from ancient sources. And I think that when we look at it from our perspective now, we'd say a lot of this might have to do with just food and water, things like this. One of the details that I really liked, there's a passage in this ancient medical author, Galen, who lived in Rome for a long period of time. And he talks about there's one aqueduct that serves Rome that brings water into Rome. And he says, don't drink from that one. If you drink from that one, diarrhea, right? That's absolutely what you're going to be getting. So again, there was this sort of awareness even from ancient authors, like that's probably not good water to drink, but I think that people might be forced to, or might not be aware, or might not know exactly what they might be getting into when they drink or eat something.
But you said summer. Why is summertime the worst time? Just like heat grows microbes or something? Or like?
I think that's a big part of it. There's also this condition where people would talk about, they talk about cholera, not in the modern sense of the disease that we know as cholera, but they talked about something called summer cholera, which was just a way of getting at, you could expect to have these sorts of issues in the summer, basically. And again, you know, it does have to do, I think, with heat and the microbial population and things like this, if we look back at it from our lens.
So you mentioned Galen a moment or two ago, and we do hear of these sort of famous doctors, people like Galen and Hippocrates, but what would your average person do? I mean, if this sort of general unhealthiness becomes really acute and you get really sick, what do you do? Is there any kind of health care?
I mean, if anything, there's probably maybe too many kinds of healthcare, although it depends on what you might have access to, right? There's lots of people in antiquity, and I think the same sort of true today. There's lots of people in antiquity who would claim that they know something about health and that they can help you with this. Whether or not they really do know that much is a different story, and so that's a big concern. When we were talking about Galen has a work that survives where it's basically, here's how you pick a doctor. Here's how you pick a doctor who actually knows what he's doing, basically, right? And it's really designed for people who have some time and money and resources. resources on their hands. So I realize that that's not going to work for everybody. But I think that the detail that always strikes me is how often people seem to be in antiquity, if they're sick or a family member's sick, how often they're considering all of their options. So never mind getting that second opinion. You've got four or five doctors arguing with each other next to you, basically, about what the best course of treatment is. And you've got to decide which one you want to go with, basically. On top of that, then, you've got temples you can potentially go to that claim that they can do some healing. You've got people that we might just call ritual healers or holy people. You've got people who sell drugs of various sorts. You've got household remedies. Sometimes a wealthier person might have enslaved people living in the house who have some medical expertise. Sometimes maybe the head of the household claims that he has some medical expertise. The source that we have in the book, there's one source where eating cabbage is the cure for everything. So it's all about cabbage, regardless of what it is, basically. And you get people who claim that they could help you. Whether or not they could is a different story.
That's amazing. Like, nothing changes. I mean, today it's exactly the same. Like, Instagram, like, there's 100,000 experts on every condition. Wow. And my wife, she believes that vinegar can pretty much cure anything. So, any combination of vinegar and some kind of herb, she's going to be on board. So, wow, things have not changed that much. That's very interesting to think about, not a scarcity of medical advice.
Yeah, but too many.
Too much medical advice. That's very interesting. Huh. All right. Well, you mentioned, ritual healers and temples that have maybe claiming some healing properties. We're the biblical time machine. We got to talk biblical stuff a little bit. So, in the New Testament, one of the major miracles that Jesus performs are healing, right? He heals all sorts of people with all sorts of ailments. When, if you read those accounts from this perspective of ancient medicine, I mean, what does Jesus kind of look like to you? Like, does he look like one of these kind of faith healers that you might see in other parts of the ancient world?
Absolutely. I think, there are so many different types of people who claimed that they could provide healing or that they could help sick people get better. And so there's these people that we might call like holy men. We might call them sorcerers or mages or exorcists or things like this. And, even when in terms of how people thought about Jesus, there's a lot of, non-Christian critics of Jesus in later periods who kind of make him out to be something like a magician, right? Like somebody who might be a little bit of a fraud potentially, right? Is the implication in some of these critical sources. So I think that in a lot of ways, Jesus doesn't look that dissimilar to people from a lot of other folks who might be around in the ancient Mediterranean world.
So what kind of treatments would you expect? I mean, if you go to one of these guys who says, I can heal you, what would you expect to get or to have him do to you?
Yeah. So we divide this up in the book into five categories. And some of them are more recognizable to us than others, but one of them is pharmacology, right? So drugs or medication. One of them is surgery, which also makes a certain amount of sense. One of them is regimen, which is a much bigger category of, kind of preventative medicine sorts of things, advice about sleeping, eating, drinking, sexual activity, all kinds of different things that a doctor or other people might give you advice on. Some of the other categories we have one on dream therapy. We have one on also, we call it therapies of touch, word, and sound. So what you're listening to, if you're being maybe massaged or someone speaking or singing to you even, there's a whole different category of treatments that people might have been thinking about in antiquity.
Well, yeah, okay, so you say pharmacology. So what counts as, ancient drugs? Were they all just kind of natural remedies, or were they actually cooking up chemicals of various types?
I mean, a little bit of both. They talk about simple treatments or compound treatments, so things that it might just be, something from a tree, something from a plant, right? But then it might also be something that you kind of mix together. You also get this big category of treatments that we just probably describe as being kind of gross,
Yes, sort of, yes, going, we love those.
Going with that idea of, you know, if you're sick enough, you really got to do that bad sort of bad sort of treatment, right? Where I'm from in Canada, there used to be a cold medication that had an advertisement that said it tastes terrible, but it works. Right. And I think that the same sort of principle was at work sometimes, right? Like, if you're really serious about this, maybe that treatment that involves urine or dung or human or animal feces, right? Things like this. Yeah. Maybe that might be something that you should be willing to consider if you're really serious about getting better. So lots of different categories here.
Oh, and do you have a favorite treatment?
I mean, the favorite treatments, you know, and this is, I apologize if this is the boring answer. The favorite treatment, there's this one medical school in antiquity that it basically said, we're going to give you safe, fast, and pleasant treatment. That's what they said. That was their sort of defining feature. And so the sorts of treatment that they recommended for people, they tended to be things like, why don't you go for a walk? Why don't you sin? Why don't you go swinging on a swing? Sing. Basically, things like this. Those would be the sorts of, they'd call them passive exercise. And those would be the types of things that they might suggest for patients, especially if you were sick enough, they'd say, you know, you're maybe not ready for the more substantial treatment. So do some of this stuff. And I think that actually kind of won people over a little bit. And I guess the good news about it is they probably weren't doing harm to people if they were advising people to go for a walk or go swing on a swing or something like that.
And hopefully they weren't charging too much for it.
Yes, true.
I mean, that is very pleasant, and I'm glad you enjoy that, but I want the nasty thing. So,
you mentioned
surgery. My God, what are we talking about? Like, they were performing surgery. We didn't have meaningful pain relief, right? Like, how was this happening?
People were potentially being held down by physician's assistants or family members, things like this. Surgery was complicated and controversial because, doctors realized this was dangerous. There were no ways of having antiseptic surgery, things like this. There were no really reliable ways of anesthesia. So surgery in that sort of sense was just going to be... You wanted to avoid it if you possibly could, basically, I think, is the philosophy that a lot of patients and a lot of doctors took.
But, like, we're like legit surgery, like, we're opening people up and moving things around on their insides. Like, that's happening.
Yes. I mean, to varying degrees, I guess, right? I suppose we're thinking about, I mean, the ones that probably are most sort of troubling to people, they did have, the Romans had cataract surgery. So, you know, they would get in and break up a cataract, basically. And it was dangerous, and they acknowledged this, right? But they actually, that was probably one of the more successful areas for this. I know that we also wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about this procedure called trepanation.
Yes,
please. Which is trying to drilling a hole into someone's skull, basically, then. And that was designed to relieve pressure on the brain, right? If someone has swelling there, they did have a way of sort of drilling in. And we have descriptions of this in ancient sources, and there's also archaeological evidence that shows that people were getting this procedure done, and we can tell from the human remains that people were surviving this procedure. So I don't mean to say that it worked necessarily, but it wasn't killing people, which I suppose is a small bar to clear, but it was something that was still potentially being used and potentially was actually maybe doing what it was supposed to, or at least maybe relieving some of the pain or the pressure that if someone had a head injury, for instance, it might have been somewhat effective for that.
Like, how bad does your headache have to be for you to be like, do it, doc, drill a hole in my head without anesthetic? I mean, it's incredible. Like you said, maybe this, the more extreme someone's condition was, the more willing they were to go to extremes to cure it. Wow. Trepanation.
So I want to bring it back to the New Testament again, that when we have Jesus, you know, normally he just heals people by saying something, you know, just a word. But every now and then we do get these stories where he sort of does something. And there's the one with the man who can't see, the blind man, and he mixes mud and saliva and then puts it on his eyes. Was this the kind of thing that other people were going around doing, or is this really unusual?
There's a lot that I can say about saliva right now.
Go on.
There's
then.
A lot that we can talk about with this. So, I mean, eye conditions were an issue, right? They were a big issue for people. So a really, really common sort of thing in all types of ways, right? No corrective lenses, yeah. No antibiotics, right? Lots of things that would lead to eye issues then. So if Jesus, you know, spits and mixes it with mud and rubs it on someone's eyes, there's another example that we have from around the same time, a little later, but there's another example where it's basically talking about how saliva has healing properties. But especially if it comes from a person who was fasting. So someone who didn't eat for a while, get their saliva. That's the good stuff, basically, then. And so the advice that we have in a source, a Roman source from the first century, basically says, if you've got dry, crusty eyes, get the saliva from someone who's been fasting and rub some of that on your eyes in the morning, and that'll take care of the problem. So no need to worry about that. So when Jesus does that in the New Testament, it's not that out of place with some of the stuff that we know about from ancient medicine, basically.
Oh, but maybe the mud was less useful.
I mean, mud could be useful in all kinds of different ways, right? Especially, you know, mud from particular types of spots, you know, soil that has a high content of clay in it, things like this. So again, we get sources that talk about, you know, using that. And I don't think that one's that that bad relative to a lot of other things that we hear about in ancient medicine. You know, rub some dirt in your eyes, that'll do it. But rub some, you know, put some clay of that has a particular, maybe particular types of properties to it, that might be a little bit more useful, basically.
Oh, that made me think of something, because I was thinking of this clay that might have, you know, mineral content in it. Like, I feel like in the ancient world I've seen, you know, sort of baths or waters or different places that were believed to have healing properties. Is that something that came up in your research? Was there a lot of that in the ancient world, people making like pilgrimages to healing waters and stuff like that?
Definitely. Yeah. You've got hot springs in different spots. There's a spot in modern Spain that was definitely used. People would bottle up the waters there, and ship them places and sell them and things like this. And people would go and they'd want to bathe. They'd want to drink. You know, archaeologists have found all sorts of drinking vessels, have fallen to the bottom of this spot, which is a sign of just how much people were going and doing that. And again, I don't think that that's that different from a lot of you know, modern forms of healing. I think about the hot springs where I live in Canada. There's some pretty famous hot springs about an hour from where I live, and those are still definitely something that people are going to for all types of reasons related to health.
There's some at Tiberias too. There's some at Tiberias on the Lake of Galilee. So, you know, I think that's partly why Herod sort of built his great sort of city there, because of the healing properties of the spa as well. But what about epidemics? You know, we're all still reeling from COVID. Was there anything like that in the ancient world, sort of plagues? You think of them as a Middle Ages thing, but were there plagues in the ancient world too?
Yeah, so several famous examples. There's a famous example. There's one in Athens in the 5th century BC. This is during this war with Sparta, and we get an eyewitness account of this from this famous historian Thucydides. And he has this awareness even of things to do with principles of contagion and a little bit to do with quarantine. He does have this awareness that you know, if people are really sick with something like this, you might not want to get that close to them, basically, right? That you might be likely to get this. And we've got other examples too. We've got another example in the time of the Emperor Justinian, so about 1,000 years after Thucydides. We have an account, and that one was going to be more like the medieval plagues, right? That was the same family of diseases that was responsible for the Black Death in medieval Europe then. We've also got a good one in the 2nd century. I shouldn't call it a good one, but we've got a significant disease event or an epidemic or even potentially a pandemic is how people are describing it now. So something called the Antonine Plague. And we do have some signs that this was actually impacting China and Asia and other regions, you know, in Eurasia at least, at the same time. So lots of examples of this. Those are probably the three most significant and famous ones from antiquity.
All right. Well, all right. We're people like Galen, you know, and other ancient medical writers, they had their own theories about kind of the origins of disease and the origins of illness. I've heard vague references to like humors and biles and like were these sort of the standard explanations for kind of how the body worked and how you kept things in balance?
Yes, for some people, but for other folks, right, all kinds of different ideas about where diseases came from. There's lots of suggestions that diseases were somehow linked to the gods in some ways, right? And if you look at the really early stories, you got the story of Pandora and the box, right? That's where disease came from, according to one version, right? Yeah. She opened it up and then diseases came out. And before that, people weren't sick, basically. You've got stories like in the Trojan War, right? In Homer's Iliad, you've got a story about Apollo who's shooting arrows of plague at the Greek army, basically, too, right? So you've got all of these divine ideas about where disease is coming from. You've got things about demons or daimons, depending on how you want to pronounce that word. You've got things about them causing illness. And then you've got all of these different medical theories. So some of them are going to be focusing on, some of them focus a lot on the digestion of food. So all disease is a source of indigestion or stomach problems, basically. That was one school of theories. That's fair enough. And then you've got other people thinking about the properties and the ratios and the balances between different substances in the body. So, Dave, when you're talking about the humors, our body has blood. It's got phlegm, it's got black bile, and it's got yellow bile. And we want to make sure that all those four things are in balance with each other. And so that was another one of the theories about where poor health came from, was those substances were not in balance in the body.
What, I just quickly, like, do we have any idea what they meant by black bile? That one always throws me. It kind of sounds so foul.
That was the one that they had to kind of infer existed, because if blood was maybe darker than it normally was, then that was the inference that there was something there that was making it darker, basically. So black bile was the one that they just kind of had to infer existed, basically. The other ones, they had more obvious signs that those things were part of the body, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about things like mental disorders, you know, what we'd call mental health issues, I suppose? I mean, you get a lot of people in the Gospels in particular who, you know, are, I mean, the Gospels, they're said to have been possessed by a demon. Was this a common understanding? And how did you sort of exorcise a demon?
So definitely that was a common understanding. You've got lots of old ideas that are sort of linking people who are experiencing madness, or who are, you know, they might have access to sort of hidden knowledge, things like this. That was always linked with it, sort of inspiration from the gods. But you've also got medical theories existing about this. So there's the famous idea in antiquity that women would experience hysteria because their wombs were not tied down in their body, and they would wander around and cause issues.
Yeah.
Yes, the wandering womb theory, right?
So was that widespread then? Do a lot of people think that?
That was a fairly widespread theory, yes. And I apologize for just saying this directly. The obvious cure for a wandering womb was pregnancy, because that would tie the womb down in the spot where it was supposed to go. So for hysteria, the obvious cure was get pregnant, basically. Then you realize there's a lot of there's a lot of attitudes about how men viewed women in the ancient world at work there. But yeah, lots of different theories. You know, there's this famous work called, a Hippocratic work that's called typically On the Sacred Disease. And people normally regard that as talking about epilepsy. So people who had seizures and that disease had this idea of that was somehow linked to the gods in some sense. And so this work by this Hippocratic author, he basically says epilepsy or this disease, whatever exactly it is not, it's not necessarily, you know, a sacred disease or especially from the gods. He says it's people have too much phlegm in their brains is the cause for it. So that's his sort of naturalistic explanation for where that's coming from, rather than this being kind of a divine sent condition.
Mm. Yeah, well, that, I mean, it reminds you of the healing in Mark, right? In the Gospel of Mark, where there's a boy is brought and he's what seems by the description to be clearly having, you know, an epileptic seizure, And in that case, you know, Jesus casts out a demon and cures him. So, yeah, I mean, it is. So you mentioned that they thought the gods and demons might have been the cause of some of these things. So would that type of healing or that type of treatment also have been common, you know, in other parts of the Mediterranean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all sorts of different theories about what was going on and about what was happening then, and about how much demons could really sort of cause these sorts of issues. But in general, there was a pretty broad consensus that this was a real thing. You do see some skepticism about how effective exorcists were, coming across both, maybe especially non-Christian sources. But you'll see someone like the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius saying, "Nah, I'm not into exorcists." Right, that's not a real thing, but we know that there's abundant evidence of this being a widely accepted practice and belief, basically. And in some cases, again, why not try everything, right? Sure. You know, something's happening and you've got five different possible ways of doing it, why not try all five? And that was a common attitude about how to get better from things in antiquity.
Wow. And am I right in thinking that some of the earliest hospitals were built by Christians to provide healthcare for the poor?
I mean, yes, pretty much. I do think it's important just to note that there were other institutions that existed in antiquity that could provide healing. So I talked about some temples. So there was this god, Asclepius. Yep. So people who were sick would go there or be brought there by their family to seek cures. And what you'd basically do, you'd go to sleep there and you'd hope that the god would send you a dream that would either make you better or give you very specific medical directions on what you should do when you woke up, basically. Oh, wow. About it. So there was this sort of interchange between the dream would heal you or the dream would give you detailed instructions on what you were meant to do the next morning about how to get better, that type of thing. We've also got things like in the Roman army, we've got Roman army camps have kind of an infirmary in them then too. So we have a range of different sorts of things that would provide healing for people. We also do have some examples. Again, I keep talking about Galen. So Galen, this Roman doctor, would talk about how he'd provide treatment to patients without any fees. And that was actually a big part of his, you know, he really valued that and liked mentioning it a lot, actually, maybe a little too much, basically. But, you know, we do have precedent for the idea of, you know, people being given healthcare without having any fees associated with it in a lot of different settings in antiquity, including in some of these early Christian hospitals that did eventually develop.
Yeah. So where do we get that idea? Like how much later were these kind of Christian hospitals starting up?
So we're thinking about those being around 4th century then, although we've got precedent for some aspects of it in earlier phases too, with, you know, Christian churches. There's this famous letter from Rome in the 3rd century that talks about all of the people who worked in the Roman church. And you've got, you know, dozens of people who were exorcists. You've got dozens of people who were in these other different capacities. So you've got this earlier side of things where Christian churches were taking care of orphan children, of widows. Things like this then too. So a whole different range of things, but the institutionalized things that seem more like what we might recognize as hospitals, again, more like 4th century for those where we start seeing real evidence for them.
Okay. And prior to that, I mean, when you talk about temples and other things, like, was there such a thing as a hospital? Like some place where there were a bunch of quote unquote, you know, physicians hanging out and lots of patients in one place, or was that a later development?
I mean, the something like the temples to Asclepius would be closer-ish to that, although less with physicians associated to some extent. I think the thing to keep in mind is that a lot of healthcare from doctors was going to be house calls in antiquity. So the same sort of dynamics. We do have some instances where it seems like doctors might be taking patients into their houses and having them stay there for a little bit. That sort of thing. But a lot of it was going to be just at home care, right? A doctor would come, you know, you've got something, the doctor's going to do that right there. And even at modern ideas about privacy in healthcare, things like this, we have these stories where it's clear, you know, someone's getting ready to have surgery, and I apologize for the detail here, but a famous story, someone's getting ready to have surgery on a condition called an anal fistula, and I'll let people figure out exactly what that is, but an unpleasant one there, and it's very clear, there's dozens of people around ready to watch this procedure happening, basically, so even the idea of privacy, even the idea of, you know, you've got your own space where you're in there with the doctor and maybe the medical staff, no, there's going to be people there to watch the show, basically. So
that's great. I'm picturing like ideas. The doctor comes in, he's like, here's what we're going to do. And then he turns around and he's selling tickets to people outside to watch. He's got like a great business going here. It's entertainment. It's medicine. Mm-hmm. Wow. I would not sign up for that show. All right. Well, Jared, you of all people should know better than to travel to the ancient world, but we do want to give you an opportunity. We have the time machine. It's all gassed up. It's humming in the next room. Where and when would you go? And yeah, what would you bring with you to stop, for, you know, prevent yourself from dying of the many diseases that are out there?
You know, I keep talking about Galen today. The second century in Rome is really a thing that interests me the most. And I'd love to kind of see what's going on. Dave, you were talking before about that idea of the physician sort of selling tickets to stuff. Galen definitely did something pretty close to that, right? When he showed up in Rome initially, he needed to make a name for himself. And so he'd put shows on and he'd do kind of borderline awful, but borderline fascinating things. You know, let's start performing surgery on this pig right now in public. And let's show what we can do, basically. So, you know, he'd come up with ways of cutting sort of things that would make the pig make noises or not, basically. So he would say, the pig will make noise now, and then I'll cut this, and it won't make noise, and then I'll restore it, and it will again, that sort of stuff. I'm not saying I want to go and watch that, but I'm really interested in just the dynamic of what was going on in that area. I don't think I'd want to eat or drink anything back then. I do feel some concerns about that, so I think I need to be prepared for that side of it at least.
You can pack a good lunch,
something to that effect. Yes.
All right. Well, Galen does sound fascinating. I mean, and I feel like his writings. I mean, didn't they basically influence medicine into like the Middle Ages and stuff? Right? Like, wasn't that he was like the source text?
Yeah, so his stuff became really influential. People in antiquity didn't want to perform autopsies or really dissect human bodies, basically, with a few exceptions here and there. So Galen did stuff with animals instead. And so a lot of ideas about how human anatomy worked were based on Galen performing dissections on animals like apes, monkeys, cows, pigs, things like this. So those stuck around for more than 1,000 years and were extremely influential for good or for bad, and often for bad, unfortunately.
Wow.
Well, very cool. Well, thank you so much, Jared. The book, again, that he co-authored with Christy Upson-Saya and Heidi Marks is called Medicine, Health, and Healing in the Ancient Mediterranean, 500 BC to 600 CE, a source book. And it is a source of all sorts of fascinating facts. It is very much for the layperson, so you would enjoy it. It's got great pictures and images of archaeological finds and medical kits and all these things. So we'll put a link in the show description where you can grab that. But thank you, Jared. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Helen. And we will see you all on the next episode of Biblical Time Machine. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to hop in and say a special thanks to all of you who answered my somewhat desperate plea in last week's episode to help support the show through the Time Travelers Club. I wanted to call out a few folks by name, at least first name. So thank you, Mark. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, John. Thank you, other John. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Helena. Thank you, Donnie. These folks are helping to make this show possible. So if you enjoy it, think about subscribing to the Time Travelers Club. It's $5 a month. It's a little more than a dollar an episode. I don't like paying for things. I don't like paying for podcasts. But shows like this rely on listener support to exist. So if you want the show to keep going, and we want the show to keep going, please subscribe to the Time Travelers Club. The link is in the show description below. And we will see you next time. Thanks.